All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for tuning in. It's the same old show, but at a new time. And what's funny is, if you're listening to the Liberty Express, it's not a new time. It's just that now the show's live at the same time that the show always was, if that makes any sense. I know what I mean, and I barely understand. Anyway. Good times. It should have been like this for a while now. I'm glad we finally got it straight. Thanks very much to Alan Butler for his cooperation in the situation. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And so now I'm live on LibertyExpressRadio.com as well as No Agenda Radio on my own website, of course, ScottHorton.org. Also at AnomalyRadio.com. And, geez, I guess I should have stopped to work things out with the guys at LibertyMovementRadio.com. Am I still on there? I'm actually not certain if I'm still on there. Anyway, it might be. And then, of course, the replay will still be going, as always, at the Liberty Radio Network. Ian Freeman and Mark Edge and their network over there at LRN.FM. It's got the thumbs up from No Agenda that the change over to the new time has gone just fine. So that's good to know. So great. All right. Hey, everybody. Check out my website. It's the new and improved. Now badass, where before it was not. The new and improved ScottHorton.org. My friend Dave made it for me. Looks real good. And there's still more improvements coming along. We're working on it. But it's way better than it's ever been, so please go and check that out, scotthorton.org. And by the way, about a week ago, I mentioned a fundraising thing that I was going to start off here on the show, and that was a little bit of a, well, you know, like Rand Paul getting ahead of himself kind of thing there. But that's all right. It's coming soon, so just you wait. I'm going to ask you for money. It's going to be great. It's going to be better than when NPR does it. It's going to be better when people sell you a bunch of crap based on fear. So it's a compromise. You know, it is what it is. It's my show. That's how it goes. All right. So, yeah, scotthorton.org. If you don't believe that I've done a bunch of interviews before, go look. There's 3,000 of them there. No lie. Now it's, you know, 3,000 and something. 3,000 interviews there at scotthorton.org. And join up the chat room. You know, I think this is a really big deal that the chat room is now finally embedded in the website. I'm not saying that's 2013 technology. I'm just saying it is when it comes to my website. And once upon a time, people used to hang around on my website. And then what happened was I got a chat room. And then everybody went to the chat room and never came back to the website again. Aha, gotcha. Now, the chat room is on the website, so you all have to hang around there if you want to. ScottHorton.org/chat. Can't get easier than that. Just make up a fake name and type in the CAPTCHA and you're in. In whichever browser you choose, right? Okay, good. So, yeah. Oh, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube /ScottHortonShow. That's how you can catch up with me on those things. /ScottHortonShow. All right, so really good show today. Should be. Actually, you know what? You might be suspicious of me with a show like this today. Well, first of all, Rachel Levinson Waldman, she wrote this great study for the Brennan Center. That's the New York University School of Law, all about the NSA spying on you. That's no problem there. But then my other two guests, former CIA guys, so that might mean that I'm a bad guy. You probably shouldn't trust me. I probably shouldn't trust these guys. However, Ray McGovern and Phil Giraldi, they've been pretty straight shooters, I think. You read what they wrote going back over the years. If they're a CIA plot, it's a CIA plot to keep us out of war. So I'll take it. It's better than the other kind. And I don't mean, you know, evil short of war as an excuse, like sanctions or something like that. Both these guys are completely good on all these things. Well, Phil Giraldi wrote a thing about, no, really, there could be a Syrian deal. It doesn't have to be a permanent state of war of all against all over there from now on. There could be a deal. Make a deal. And Ray McGovern, why, he's just back from Russia. Which, that must be about as ironical as hell to him. The longtime Russia analyst at the CIA for 27 years. An analyst of the Soviet Union. Over there giving an award named after Sam Adams to Edward Snowden. Well, as you'll find out, it's not Sam Adams like in the beer. It's not Sam Adams as in the Revolutionary War hero either, although he must have been named after him and maybe was his great-great-grandson or something. But no, Sam Adams, as I'm sure Ray McGovern will explain, was a CIA analyst who told the truth within the system, but was a whistleblower, an attempted whistleblower, I guess, within the system, about the true strength of the North Vietnamese enemy in that war, when the generals were trying to sell a much lower number for their own interested reasons. And it's a funny kind of award, because it's an award for a guy who could have stopped the war if he'd been brave enough to go to the newspapers. I don't know. But he didn't, and so he didn't, and so millions of people died. Pretty good guy to name an award after. I don't know. It has a nice ring to it, though, the Sam Adams Award. But anyway, so Ray McGovern, he went to give the award to Edward Snowden for being a whistleblower. And you know, a good friend of mine, I says, hey, you know what's funny? Ray McGovern and Colleen Rowley and the people who have gone to give this award to Edward Snowden in Russia, these are friends of mine. I got these people in my cell phone, you know? And my friend looked at me and was like, oh, man. Like, that's a bad problem. Like, what they've done is wrong because what he's done is wrong, and they must be wrong to support that kind of thing, and these are the kind of people that you're running around with. And I'm going, man, Ray McGovern is a former CIA officer. Colleen Rowley is the former lawyer for the FBI office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Yeah, there's some pretty hardcore Marxist radicals, I guess, huh? How could I be palling around with, you know, such low lives as them? Oh, no. They're fine. And they went over to give that award to Ed Snowden because what he did was a great thing. And if you got that wrong, well, you just got that wrong. It ain't them, it's you. No offense, but it's pretty easy to tell whether you're bad on that or not. Anyway, so Ray McGovern's going to be here to talk about Ed Snowden. So that should be a good show, right? By the way, the Rachel Levinson-Waldman interview, that should be really good because the thing that she wrote, very in-depth explanation. And I admit I ran out of time. I did not allocate enough time to reading that whole thing. And I had enough time. I just did not allocate well. But I read a lot of it. And it's good enough that I swear to myself I am going to finish it even after the interview is over. I need to understand this stuff. It's hard for me. Some of you people, maybe you're a computer programmer for a living, and so whatever Greenwald says, Ed Snowden says, you go, oh yeah, I understand exactly what that means. But for my brain, not so much. I read Bamford's book, and then I listened to the audiobook, and I understood it all for a while, but then it kind of went away again. Because I ain't quite that engineering-minded. Anyway, so it's good for me to read this kind of thing over and over again. Exactly. Never mind hyperbole. Never mind what we all know and that kind of thing. Exactly what's going on according to these documents. What the NSA is doing to us. What do we know so far for real? Anyway, so that should be a really good interview. I'm looking forward to talking with her. So yeah, good. All right, so now is the part of the show where I talk about other stuff. Oh, you know what? I should talk about Liberty Express. I've been on Liberty Express for about half a year. Alan Butler, the host of Butler on Business, he's the guy who's behind the whole thing. And obviously it's awesome. And Peter Schiff is on here. And very soon, anyway, there's a couple of technical difficulties need to be worked out, I guess. But very soon, the great Tom Woods will be on, and his spot will be right before me. In other words, yay, I get to ride Tom Woods' coattails. And for that matter, Peter Schiff's coattails, and hopefully spread the message of anti-interventionism to all y'all. So it's a really cool thing. Everybody on there has a legit show and on a terrestrial AM station somewhere or something. And it's a great thing, and I think it's going to be a real radio network sooner rather than later. So I'm very happy to be here. I'm very thankful to Charles Goyette for introducing me to Alan. I'm very thankful for Alan for having me on and having me on his show every Tuesday to promote it and all that, which is great. So, good times. Hi, Liberty Express audience. Thanks very much for having me. I'm here live now in the same time slot I always was, but now live, 3 to 5 Eastern time. And you know, I never really was a morning person, man. I don't know how the hell I ended up getting in the position where my show was always in the morning. But I think this 2 in the afternoon thing is going to be better. And I'm not saying that today is going to be the very best example of that. Although, got some pretty good guests lined up. But I think having the show come on, I'm in Texas, so 2 to 4 Texas time, I think that's going to work out for me. I think I like the feeling of that. Now, might have to, you know, get to my second pot of coffee right around the start of the show time, but that's all right. I like pots of coffee. I can work with that. So, you know, I would have a night show, really. I could definitely see the show at night having a whole different feeling to it. But the problem with that is interviews. People are trying to eat their dinner. They're trying to hang out with their husbands and their wives and their kids and their people. And you know what I mean? Business hours is better. So, you know, 3 to 5 Eastern time, that's pushing it business hours wise as it is. And of course, you know, in England, we're talking 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. If I'm going to talk to Adam Morrow in Cairo, it's going to be difficult. He's got work in the morning. So, this is about as late in the day as I can make my show and still hope to ever interview anybody from the old world at all. And it's going to make it even a little bit more difficult to interview East Coast people. But it's going to make it a lot easier to interview West Coast people. So anyway, I don't know. It's going to be good for my attitude. I don't know if it'll be good for the listenership, but I guess we'll see. But I've got a positive attitude about it. Seems like maybe it's a change that's long overdue or something like that. All right. Also got to announce a new sponsor I got on the show. And, you know, I really should have talked about the 10th Amendment Center more. I did interview Michael Bolden from the 10th Amendment Center, so that's pretty good. But I'm very happy to have the 10th Amendment Center on. And they've got a thing, offnow.org. Also, nullifynsa.com or .org or something. NullifyNSA, just search that. And their thing is to turn off the water to the NSA complex in Utah. It's all local and state water, and it's up to them. And there is no mandate in the Constitution that they have to aid and abet crimes to the national government whatsoever. And there he came on citing chapter and verse from all the court cases and whatever. Just like when Sheriff Mack won his case on the 10th Amendment, saying the feds cannot force the locals to carry out their background checks for them. So, by that same principle, turn off the water. Oh, too bad for you. Your big brother slave state surveillance system doesn't work because we turned off your water. That's called nullification and interposition. Oh, yeah. Break out with it. I think that's so cool. Get it done. And, you know, they've done great work on guns and on pot. They're great libertarians over there at the 10th Amendment Center, Michael Bolden and them. They are highly worthy of your support, and especially get involved in this thing in Utah, even if you're not from there. It's a national issue. It's a global issue. Interpose yourself. I'm not sure how, but you figure it out, you know. Be nice. But I like the idea. Turn off the water. Turn off the water. Simple as that. That's off now, and nullify NSA. I forget all the .coms and orgs, but you can find them online. Simple as that. The 10th Amendment Center has all the links for you there. So that's great. And then also, I'm really excited about this one, guys. It's myheroesthink.com. Myheroesthink.com. And what it is, should I ruin it for you? Maybe I should just tell you that later on in the show, you will hear a commercial for it. Or right now, you could just Google it and look with your eyes yourself. I guess I'll just tell you, since now I just gave you the perfect way to ruin the surprise. You want the surprise? Their resin, high quality, really great stuff. Resin busts of Mises, Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. Can you believe that? And I've got the Harry Brown one, and it's awesome. And every time I look at it, I go, yeah, man, Harry Brown. I love it. I do. I love it. And that's not just salesmanship and BS, because you know what? I'm not very good at lying to you about stuff. I try sometimes, but it doesn't really work too well. But this thing, I love it. It's great. And in fact, I didn't hear back from the guy forever. Hey, what the hell? You sent me this awesome Harry Brown bust. I was going to tell everybody about how to give you money in exchange for them, and then I never heard from you again. But then, blam, I heard from him again. And now, blam, it's on. As Brad himself put it, crony capitalism. Me and him. Cronies now. I tell you about the awesome stuff he sells. You give him money in exchange for the awesome stuff he sells. And I know that not everybody is a Rothbardian libertarian. But if you are, you're going to want one of these, man. And not everybody's a Harry Brownian, but if you love Harry Brown, then you probably, like me, love Harry Brown a lot. And so, I don't even have to say it. It sells itself. You want a bust of Harry Brown on your bookshelf or you don't? Are you kidding me? I've got one and I like it. What can I tell you? Great bust of Harry Brown, Ron Paul, Murray Rothbard, and Ludwig von Mises. And there are more coming, too. I believe Bastiat and Hayek and George Carlin are coming out. And they got different sizes, too. Large and small. So, I mean, what the hell can I say? Does that sell itself or not? You want busts of Harry Brown and Ron Paul and Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises in your place, or you don't want those? In your office? As a gift for your nutty libertarian friend? It's on! We're gonna sell a million of these! It's somebody or other's law that if I had read Mises in them, I would know better. Somebody or other's law. Supply creates demand. Well, look, everybody. Armloads of Harry Brown statues. I dare you to look away. That's myheroesthink.com. Myheroesthink.com. That's got to be the coolest thing since the commodity disc. I'm a really lucky guy. You know, I don't make a lot of money doing this, but I sure am happy with the sponsors I got. I stand behind them 100%. What? Tom Woods teaching people stuff? A silver disc with a QR code for the instant spot price on the back? The Council for the National Interest sticking it to the Israelis? Hell yes! I love this job.
Hi, I'm Brad Newman. I'm the creator of MyHeroesThink.com. Are you a fan of Ron Paul, Harry Brown, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises? Me too. These guys are my intellectual heroes, and because I can, I've decided to create my own monuments to them. So I'm bringing back the head bust. Visit myheroesthink.com and check out my artwork. Maybe you still have 5 empty inches on your bookshelf, or some space next to your computer. Maybe you'd enjoy having a statue of the libertarian who inspired you to think. Maybe you know a young person who just found these ideas and you'd like to inspire them with a gift. I really can't think of people with more integrity to look up to. Visit myheroesthink.com and sign up for the mailing list. Be the first to know when my Hayek and Hazlitt statues become available. Most importantly, be sure to type Scott Horton into the promo line so we can help support this show, because I'm sick of bombing people. Visit myheroesthink.com.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. I gotta tell you, it was pretty cool before the show today. I got all nervous, you know, just from the new time. I don't know. My subconscious knows that there's a possibility that new people are listening. And it was just a good feeling because it reminded me of old days, I guess. You know, I never really talked about this, but for years and years, I would be so nervous up until the moment of starting the show, and then I'd be all right again. But I always just, oh man, that feeling in my stomach and whatever. Always just nervous before the show. And then at some point, it just went away, and I didn't even notice when it went away. I just noticed that it had gone away quite some time ago at some point. Oh yeah, I guess I don't really get nervous before the show anymore. But then today, I got that feeling again. Oh, man, I hope they like me. Well, anyway. So, listen, there's this girl, Malala. Malala? I don't know how to say it because I don't really pay attention to this thing. And I'll tell you why I don't. Because it's just like some Jessica Lynch, you know, screw your brain job, right? Oh, TV came up with a narrative that I'm supposed to be really concerned about, huh? Well, that's your number one way to get me to not care about something. And I'm sure she's a nice girl, and I'm sure the guy that shot her in the head was a real jerk, and I'm sure that literacy for young females is extremely important no matter where in the world you are. But come up with a Jessica Lynch story for me, and nah, I don't care about that. It's amazing to me that people get caught up in whatever is put in front of them, like it's just dog food. Oh, the Malala thing. Isn't that the most important thing this month I'm supposed to care about? Well, I don't know. Again, nothing personally against her. Just against the narrative that I'm supposed to be involved in. It's like the Aruba abductee or whatever. I just... Nope. Dancing with the Stars. Never saw it. Malala, yeah, no, don't care about that. Except, I thought this was really cool. She goes to the Oval Office, and the headline is important. The headline is Malala Yousafzai. I'm saying it wrong. Yousafzai. I think. Malala Yousafzai tells Obama drones are fueling terrorism. Well, you got that right. But even more important than that, because I thought, aw, don't tell me now that she just gave him a utilitarian argument, because, no, of course, here's what she said. She's talking about what she said. I thanked President Obama for the United States' work. So I guess they didn't have an open mic at the time to catch the exact words, but whatever. In a statement released after the meeting, she says she was honored to meet with Obama, but she told him she worried about the effect of U.S. drone strikes. Quote, I thanked President Obama for the United States' work in supporting education in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and for Syrian refugees, she said in the statement. I also expressed my concern that drone attacks are fueling terrorism. Innocent victims are killed in these acts, and they lead to resentment among the Pakistani people. I'm sorry, I'm so used to saying Iraqis, it's hard to stop. If we refocus efforts on education, it will make a big impact. So, what's hilarious is I saw a couple of places in real life, and I don't think that this was people mocking Democrats. I think this was actual Democrats being retweeted around saying, nuh-uh, you're a liar. It's impossible that she would have said that to my dear leader who I love so much because... That's what I want to believe, or whatever. Just amazing. So I guess, you know, it is hearsay, but it's hearsay from her, or, you know, her people released saying that she said that anyway. And I hadn't heard that the White House disputed that she said that. And then, so the joke is, of course, that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee rejected Malala and gave the Peace Prize this year to the Chemical Weapons Organization, which is important, but, you know, it's not like anybody uses chemical weapons on each other very much or anything. Education for young girls is a big issue. Anyway, so there's the Peace Prize rejectee telling the Peace Prize winner, "You're killing innocent people. Please stop." And it's too bad, actually, that the way it's worded isn't, "Oh, yeah, and also, by the way, it's counterproductive and you're creating more terrorists and all that." Because the thing is, it's wrong to kill innocent people even if there are no consequences other than you become a horrible devil in your own soul for all those people you killed, you know? Or guilt-ridden trauma, or, you know, exactly however that works. Even if there are no consequences for you, even if you get away with it scot-free, even if you don't bring on blowback against your neighbors, still wrong to kill people, right? Yeah. So that's the headline. And then, you know, what she says is a mathematical fact. It's not a matter of opinion or, hey, you know, that's what some people think or anything along those lines whatsoever. It's not even a study showed. It's a fact. Take, for example, Faisal Shahzad that attempted to blow up Times Square, and thank goodness he was too stupid or just, you know, not skilled enough to pull it off. His bomb was a dud, basically. The fuse fizzled and the reaction was not achieved, thank God. But just assume that he'd been more competent, that he'd been better trained or had access to whatever materials he needed or whatever. He made it all the way into Times Square with a truck full of a bomb and was trying to kill a lot of people. So just, you know what, it might as well have actually happened. You know what I mean? That's the way I think of it. And what was he doing there? Well, he was an American with a good job and a wife and a business and a degree, I think an advanced degree, some kind of engineer or something. Then he went back home to Pakistan and he saw innocents who'd been killed in drone strikes. Or, you know, at least the aftermath or whatever. And so he joined up the war on the other side. It's just true. Never mind the consequences for all the poor Pakistani innocents caught between the different sides, you know? But anyway, you know, it'd be fun to, not that I'm up for it. Maybe you got the stomach for it, not me, but somebody ought to watch MSNBC and see how much coverage this gets, what Malala told Obama. I'm watching CNN International and plenty of coverage of her and no coverage of this as far as I can tell. I got the closed captions on.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Rachel Levinson Waldman. She is counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. That's the Brennan Center at the New York University School of Law. And she's got well, a whole bunch of stuff that needs reviewing here. First and foremost, what the government does with Americans' data. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Rachel?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very happy to have you here. And I admit, I did not budget my time well, and I had to quit about halfway through this thing this morning before the show.
Understood.
But
it's long.
It was so good that it's one of the very small percentages of things that I'm going to, I swear, finish even after the interview's over. Because it's really good, and I really need a thorough understanding of this so I can teach it myself as best I can, and it's all such a complicated thing. But anyway, so I want to start the interview with pretty much the same way that the study starts off with, is reviewing a little bit of the history of Nixon era and really J. Edgar Hoover era abuses and what happened, the pushback from that in the 1970s, and then, of course, you know, how that pushback has become undone, basically, since September 11th and the steps that have been taken, where, in other words, where we are now on the slippery slope compared to then and that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah. So do you want me to start out just sort of talking about the history, where some of this stuff came from?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. So to give a little background for your listeners on the report overall, what I talk about in the report is, as you say, what the government is doing with Americans' data. And what I mean when I say that is specifically, what is the government doing with non-criminal information about Americans that it's gathering? The idea being that post 9/11, the government has much more authority. It was given much more legal authority. It's interpreted the legal authority that it has fairly broadly to allow it to connect, to allow it to collect a lot of information that's not necessarily connected to, you know, suspicion of criminal activity or a very specific, you know, national security threat. And so the way I start off this report, as you say, is looking at the history, kind of how did we get to this point? And it's, I think it's impossible to understand both what's happening now and the significance of it without understanding the sort of 1960s, 1970s era abuses and then reforms. So what we learned about from the Church Committee, of course, this was the Senate Committee. Senator Frank Church was the head of it, and this was put into place to find out basically what had J. Edgar Hoover been doing at the FBI, what had the CIA been doing, what had the NSA been doing. And in 1976, the Church Committee released this amazing, thousands of pages long report saying there had really been significant abuses across the board. So the FBI had been engaged in targeting women's liberation movements, black student unions, Martin Luther King Jr., a whole variety of domestic kind of political activism and social activism movements. And they found the same at the CIA and the NSA. So the CIA also was infiltrating, you know, protest movements, various domestic groups. The CIA at one point was taking and reading every single foreign telegraph that was leaving from the United States that Americans were sending overseas. The NSA was looking at the content of every single one of these. And so across these agencies, they were taking in information about thousands of Americans who weren't doing anything wrong, who were just engaged in a variety of activities. And by and large, these programs for all of them started fairly modestly. You know, they had fairly modest goals, but this was happening in secret. It was at a time where there was this incredible fear of communism, and so their activities just kind of grew and grew and grew, and the powers that they'd taken grew and grew and grew. So the Church Committee releases this report. It's a huge issue, and in response, there are a variety of protections put into place. So just before the Church Committee report, Congress passed something called the Privacy Act, which was meant to protect a lot of personal information about Americans and give Americans the right to find out what information about them do federal agencies have. Then after that, there were restrictions put into place on what the FBI could do domestically. There was something called the Attorney General's Guidelines that the Attorney General at the time put into place, and then something that, you know, for better or worse, you and your listeners might be becoming more and more familiar with, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which put much more court oversight, basically, over kind of national security and foreign intelligence work that the NSA and the FBI do. And so that was what was in place up until 9/11, certainly with changes, and we can get into more of the details of that. But there were these basic protections in place, and there was kind of a basic understanding that generally First Amendment-protected activity would be protected. So, you know, speech, association, things like that got heightened protection. There was this judicial review over a variety of things, and that people couldn't be targeted, generally didn't have foreign intelligence investigations opened on them or information gathered unless they themselves were an agent of a foreign power, things like that was fairly restricted. After 9/11, really, the floodgates opened. You know, there was this feeling there had been this horrific attack that had been missed. And so kind of on all levels, the Patriot Act was passed. That made changes across the board. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was amended in a number of different ways. And so what you started to see was a lot more information coming in about Americans that wasn't necessarily connected to somebody acting on behalf of a foreign power or somebody engaging in criminal activity. And so then what we were interested in is what happens next? What happens to all of that information that's been brought in?
Right. Okay, now, so to rewind to the Bush Jr. years here just a minute, how far with Stellar Wind and the rest of what they were doing in secret up until the New York Times finally exposed it in 2005, how much further were they going beyond FISA, beyond the Patriot Act?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. So with those programs, things like warrantless wiretapping, all of these things that were being undertaken in secret for the 4 or 5 years after 9/11, they were certainly going beyond what the law allowed at the time. I think that was pretty clear that it was in violation of what the law allowed. That being said, when that information was revealed, as you say, the New York Times article in 2005, the public suddenly starts to learn much more about what the government has been doing in secret. By and large, kind of the changes, the statutory revisions that were made in response to that were simply to, by and large, allow the government to continue doing the same things, but write it into law. Mm-hmm. And so what we see now is, in a lot of ways, even an expansion of the ways in which the law was changed just after 9/11 to allow then what Bush II kind of did to push those laws even more.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then a big part of it that you talk about in the study, too, is the sharing and how it ends up between government departments and agencies, that is, and how that ends up becoming a major loophole in probable cause requirements and that kind of thing, because the different agencies have different levels and then they all share it together in one kind of pool of information. And this seems to me, especially as the technology gets better and better, the networks between the different government agencies, computer systems get better and better, where you're going to end up having the full intelligence capability of the national government turned against the American people for use in their local and state prosecutions. And then we'll all be in prison.
Well, and this is a really interesting piece of it. This isn't something that I get into in detail quite as much in the report, but very much so. So not just are there a lot of sharing capabilities and really sharing mandates at the federal level. I mean, this was a big change after 9/11. I walked through, you know, there are statutes, multiple statutes, executive orders, presidential orders, you name it, ordering the federal agencies to share more and more. But absolutely, it goes down to the local and state level as well. And increasingly, there's information that, you know, wouldn't have been gathered originally, but is there and becomes more and more accessible. Increasingly, there's a lot more sharing between local, state, and federal level in terms of biometric information. And so a lot of that becomes accessible to law enforcement on all levels.
Right. And, of course, all we need is a crisis that hadn't quite happened yet, but as soon as it does happen, then that'll be the excuse for it, whether it's a really famous missing kid or an illegal immigrant commits a crime or a terrorist does a suicide bombing at a mall somewhere or something that'll be bad enough where, you know, we have all of this It seems a waste that we're not turning over all this metadata to the local prosecutors who could use it to keep us all safe, for crying out loud.
Right, right. And I think certainly that's what we've seen after 9/11, is that sort of, you know, crises. I think crises always create sort of this feeling of emergency. And in some ways, one of the unique things after 9/11 is that we haven't stepped back much sort of from that feeling, and in terms of, you know, how it's being used to collect and share information. And I think that's right, that if there is another sort of major crisis, then it does create an additional opening.
All right. And now, you know, I've heard there's been and I've read a bit of coverage about the fusion centers in the past, but not that much. And I was wondering, you know, it seems like a good opportunity to give the audience a glimpse of what these things really are and how much of a change they are in the form of the police structure in America from the way things were before, not long ago.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk a bit about fusion centers. So fusion centers are these state and regional centers, there's sort of no better way to describe them, that were established in the years after 9/11. It's a little confusing to figure out kind of exactly when the first one was established. The structures were put in place between about 2004 and 2007. And the idea was that, you know, sort of before 9/11, there had been all this information coming in from different areas, but, you know, the term often used, it was stovepiped. You know, people who needed to know all the information didn't know pieces of it. And so the idea was that fusion centers would provide a place where really a whole variety of people, of entities, could come together to share information. So you have local, state, and federal law enforcement. There are these things called joint terrorism task forces, which also bring together law enforcement and intelligence on various levels. They generally have a place at a fusion center. Private entities can, so, you know, private companies basically that have their own major security apparatus, they can have a place at a fusion center. So there are a couple of, I think, really interesting things about fusion centers for our purposes. One is that there's a huge amount of money that's been poured into fusion centers, largely by the Department of Homeland Security. As you probably know, there was a scathing report that came out about a year ago from a Senate subcommittee saying, among many other things, that the Department of Homeland Security hadn't tracked that money at all. There was basically no way of knowing really how it had been spent, where the money had gone, if it had produced anything of value. And the report found a couple of other things that I think are relevant here, and this has been reported on in other areas as well. One is that a lot of these fusion centers have grown from being terrorism or counterterrorism focused to what's called, all risks or all hazards. So they deal with, you know, there could be a hurricane coming in. The fusion center, you know, helps combine information about that. There could be, you know, a large rally that's being planned, a fusion center helps gather information about that, which all sounds perfectly useful. But the reason that's happening, frankly, is because there aren't actually that many terrorism risks in the country. And so the fusion centers basically were being given millions of dollars by the Department of Homeland Security, and most of them across the country didn't actually have enough counterterrorism work to spend that money on. And so they expanded to cover lots and lots of other purposes. The other thing that this subcommittee report found is that, by and large, a lot of the information that was being fed into fusion centers and coming back out was worthless. It was worse than worthless. You know, the people weren't exercising good judgment about what they were putting in. There was information that reflected protected speech. There was information that was available elsewhere. And so, you know, there were sort of these sinkholes of money that weren't providing much value.
Right. Well, and it seems like all of this, especially when you get back to the NSA level of vacuuming up everything, the Snowden revelations, that kind of stuff. You know, I think Bamford puts it this way in his book, The Shadow Factory, he may be quoting one of them, actually, that they're always trying to surf on this ocean of data rather than drown in it. But they're always drowning in it. And, you know, it's just like, you know, searching every baby and little old lady at the airport. You know, it's like that movie Airplane, actually, where they're hassling the nobodies and the real terrorists go through the metal detector with a rocket launcher. You ever seen that one?
It's just like that. Airplane is one of my favorite movies. I love Airplane.
Yeah, yeah. So you got the Boston attack, you got Fort Hood, you have Faisal Shahzad in Times Square. You have all these real attacks, which thankfully have been relatively small compared to what they could have been, as horrible as they actually were. But all these have happened while they're busy chasing their tail and trapping nobodies and spying on everybody and frisking everybody.
Well, and this is one of the things that we talk about, sort of the notion, right, that there are huge amounts of information coming in. But then the fact, in a lot of circumstances, that's actually making it harder to pinpoint the key pieces of information. And you've had people, you know, it's not just the Brennan Center saying this. You have officials from the CIA, from the Department of Homeland Security, from the Department of Defense going on record and saying, as you said, we are drowning in this information. It is clogging up the system. People are afraid not to collect every single thing that's out there, but it's not actually helpful. And even if you go back to the 9/11 Commission report, which said, you know, there was all of this, there was a lot of information that was available, but it wasn't being shared. And often that's used to say, well, you know, what the 9/11 Commission was saying is there are all these dots that weren't being connected. We have to collect all the dots. Really, what the 9/11 Commission said, and it is a much longer read than my report, although it's fascinating. Really what it said is there were major alerts that were coming into the government that were being ignored. It didn't take a whole lot to spot those in the noise because they said things like, you know, somebody is planning to fly a plane into the World Trade Center, but also that the dots of information that were missed were largely dots that were connected to known terrorists, that were connected to criminal activities, things like passport fraud, visa fraud, things like that. And so this wasn't, the 9/11 Commission doesn't say, oh, if only the government had sifted through information about innocent Americans, they could somehow these plots would have emerged. They said really what needed to have been done was good old-fashioned detective work, starting with leads connected to criminal activity and connected to known terrorists.
Right. I mean, even Colleen Rowley, who was Time Magazine Person of the Year back in 2002 for blowing the whistle, she said, and this is just from her angle, her part in the story, was that if her bosses had allowed the FBI agents at the Minneapolis office to go ahead and ask the judge for a FISA warrant, which they would have gotten no problem with all the information that they already had on Moussaoui and his brother, that they could have, through his papers and through his cell phone stuff, they could have directly traced him to Mohammed Atta and the rest of the leaders of the bad guys in Florida. That would have been it. They could have rolled up the 9/11 plot, and that's not some craziness. That's from Colleen Rowley. And there are a lot more, as you said, there are all kinds of alerts coming in from all different directions. So that's not, it's not that that was the only chance they had. And in other words, they had all the power in the world to stop that attack if they'd been doing their job.
Yeah, no,
they didn't
I think
need
that's
a new Patriot
right.
Act whatsoever. They didn't need anything more other than competence.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The powers in place, the authorities in place were quite strong at the time. I think that's right.
Yeah, they make it sound like, oh, geez, you know, the FBI never had the power to look into anybody before. I guess we need to start doing that.
Right.
And that actually worked, I guess, while people were still afraid, they were able to make that seem legitimate to people. Very strange.
Right. And it's one of the very interesting things, I think, about where we are now is that it looks like, you know, given the revelations that have come out, you know, the information that Edward Snowden has disclosed and then what the NSA is increasingly starting to release, you know, one of the things that I'm feeling somewhat hopeful about is that we're actually at a moment where the public is really starting to become kind of much more educated about what's been happening. Certainly we are learning, you know, I think it doesn't matter how steep you are in this. We are all learning a huge amount from what's come out over the last few months. Mm-hmm. And that we may finally have a moment where some of this, you know, some of the authorities might be dialed back, at least to some extent, that there's enough kind of public interest and public concern mm-hmm. that we may be at a bit of a historical moment.
Yeah, it seems like the sort of common refrain that, well, we're not really learning anything new. It's, yeah, compared to our worst fears of what we thought might be going on, right? And then, what this is confirming everything you were afraid that you already knew, but it was just your intuition then. Now you got the documents at The Guardian.
Right. Well, and, you know, it's interesting. We've been, you know, talking about this with folks and sort of, you know, among the community. I think one of the points that couple of people have made, which I think is a really fair point, is that, you know, there's been litigation going on over a variety of these issues for several years in terms of trying to learn more about these policies, and especially in terms of trying to challenge some of these laws. And, you know, by and large, the position of the administration from Bush into Obama has been basically, there's very little that we can disclose. Nobody is affected by this. And then now that this information is coming out, they're sort of switching. In some ways, it's sort of a messaging thing to say, oh, well, these powers have been in effect forever. This is old news. It's nothing new. They've been in effect for too long, really, to change them. And so it's kind of this 180-degree switch. But in fact, it's significant information that we're learning about. I think to some extent, it confirms what people had suspected from a combination of, you know, great investigative reporting, whistleblowers, things like that, but hadn't quite been able to confirm. And some of it, I think, truly is beyond really what people in any of these communities suspected what was happening in terms of the ways that some of the laws are being interpreted.
Well, be specific there. What do you think is the worst, the most shocking thing that people probably did not anticipate?
I think the most shocking thing, and this is getting a little bit into the legal weeds, but this is probably overall something that most of your listeners are familiar with. You know, one of the very first things that we learned about is that the NSA is gathering this whole database of Americans' phone calls. So, you know, it's what's called metadata. So they're not wiretapping the phone calls, they're not listening into the content, but they're getting information about when a call was made, who it was placed to, how long it lasted. Just about every single phone call placed domestically and placed from the U.S. going internationally. The NSA keeps those records for 5 years. What they say is that they only search them under fairly limited circumstances. It's sort of specifically related to terrorism. We've learned two really important things from this. One is that, you know, one of the things we've learned from these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions that have been released is that the restrictions they say that they've put in place, some of them have never worked. Some issues they didn't reveal to the court for 3 years. The court has accused the NSA of lying to the court over and over again. The Department of Justice had to go to the court to say, FYI, we've just realized the NSA is doing this. So, you know, one of the things the NSA relies on is we have all of this oversight in place. And I think what these opinions have revealed is that, by and large, that oversight is pretty weak. The major legal issue is that the statute, the part of the Patriot Act that ostensibly allows the NSA to gather this information, requires the FBI to make a case to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that the information that it's getting is relevant to a counterterrorism investigation. And basically, the court became convinced, yes, every single phone call, information about every single phone call, is relevant to a counterterrorism investigation, not because it's all relevant now, and not because most of it is ever going to be relevant, but because the kind of analysis that the NSA does, what they call contact chaining and communities of interest, is reliant on having a huge bank of data. That's how they run these analyses. And so the court said, yep, that's fine with us. We think that satisfies. And that interpretation of relevance is beyond, I think, anything that, you know, would ever sort of pass the laugh test under any other circumstances. And it doesn't exclude any other huge volume of data supposedly being relevant as well.
You're
so
saying,
I think
you're
in
saying
a lot of
that,
ways, that's the most disturbing thing.
You're saying, Rachel, that they're saying that everybody's communication counts as relevant basically as the control in their various experiments when they're checking their new data off of everything else in the whole world that they already know to look for an anomaly. So they're taking it for granted that all of this stuff is just normal people living their everyday lives. But they say to the court, yeah, but we need that so that we'll notice the screwy things. And the court says, okay, fine, so you can keep everything on Scott Horton or Rachel's list, too.
Right, so it's close to that. It's not quite so much that it's control. The idea is that you have, who knows, you know, say there's a million pieces of information. There's way, way more than that. Say there's a million pieces. And say it turns out that three of those pieces of information are somebody who's connected to Al-Qaeda abroad calling me in the States and then me calling somebody else. But right now, They don't know who that person abroad is. They don't have any reason to suspect me. But 3 years down the line, something might come up. So they want this database of information just to be sitting there. So at the point where they think, oh, we need to conduct a search, we need to conduct this analysis, they have all of these phone calls kind of cached and sitting there waiting to be used. And, of course, one of the concerns is that, you know, what they call metadata, and they keep saying it's not content, there's nothing to worry about. There is often so much more, so much sensitive information that you can learn about somebody from this information about who do they call, when do they call them, how long do they spend on the phone, things like that. It is very vulnerable to abuse.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sorry that we're out of time. Half an hour always goes so fast, and there's still so much to talk about, but there's a dispute right now. I don't know if you cover this in your piece. I'm sorry I didn't get that far, but... Is it clear or not yet whether the metadata, the phone metadata there, includes your phone's location everywhere you go to? Because I always wonder whether they follow me to the living room and back, you know? Or follow me to the kitchen. You know, yeah, there, look, he went to the kitchen again.
Right, what's he doing in there? That's a really good question. This has absolutely been an issue of major debate. My sense from what we know so far is that this database probably doesn't include location information. The NSA has said that they did a several years long experiment with gathering location information. They abandoned it in 2011, but Senator Wyden, who is a senator on the Intelligence Committee, he's basically been sending up smoke signals saying there is more there that they're not telling you. Right. So I think we know that there's more to learn about the NSA gathering location information. We just don't quite know which program it's sitting in.
Right. Yeah, I do know from Bamford's book back when, before any of the Snowden stuff came out, that after they closed down Total Information Awareness under Admiral Poindexter, that they just moved it to the NSA and renamed it Basketball. And I guess they cut it in thirds, and then they made up names for the new things, too. But and just, oh, you don't like the thing that we're doing? We'll just make it more secret and then continue.
Right, right.
That's their regular modus operandi or whatever. All right, anyway, so I'm sorry that we're all out of time because I wanted to ask you about the border searches and the Five Eyes loophole and all of this stuff. There's all kinds of stuff, but you're on my list of NSA experts now, so thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right, everybody, that's Rachel Levinson Waldman. She's counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program at the New York School of Law. We'll be right back after this. New York University School of Law, I meant to say, yeah. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're at scotthorton.org. And we're also at Liberty Express Radio, at No Agenda Radio, at Anomaly Radio. We will be repeated at the Liberty Radio Network, and on and on and on like that. Isn't that nice? All right. Today's the first show in the new time slot. I'm liking it. I think it's good. I think I'm better in the afternoon than in the morning. Maybe that's just me. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right, good. Ray McGovern's on the show. Hey, Ray, how are you doing?
Doing fine, Scott.
Good, good. Hey, everybody, you know Ray McGovern. He's an anti-war activist, big time, all over the place on every subset of American foreign policy that you could think of, from Guantanamo to each and every one of the wars and all the rest of it. And now here he is. He went with really the A-team of the whistleblower group over there, Jocelyn Raddick, who's a whistleblower on the John Walker Lind case and now a huge whistleblower advocate. Colleen Rowley, who, as we just talked about with the previous guest, she and her compatriots at the FBI office in Minneapolis could have stopped 9/11 if their bosses had let them. And Thomas Drake, the famous NSA whistleblower. And you guys went to Moscow to give the Sam Adams Award to Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. So tell us all about your trip. Tell us all about the Sam Adams Award. Take half an hour. Tell us whatever you want, Ray. I know you got stuff to say.
Okay. Well, it was quite an adventure. The Sam Adams Award stems from a colleague of mine who entered the CIA as an analyst on the same day I did, during the presidency of John Kennedy. He was given the account to count up, to figure out the OB, the order of battle, of the Vietnamese communists under arms in South Vietnam. And he did an assiduous job, collected all manner of information from all kinds of sources, and came up with a figure about 500,000 to 600,000. Then he went over to Saigon, and General Westmoreland said, no, it can't be more than 299,000.
Yeah.
That makes you suspicious. I mean, the precision of that 299, that's sort of like, you know, 1,429 people killed by those chemical things in Damascus.
Yeah,
you know,
like that. Yep.
So, anyhow, he was baffled until one fellow came up to him at the bar that night and said, "Now, Mr. Adams, you got to realize that your figures are right, but they're always going to have them. Always going to cut them in half because, you know, they can't let the folks in Saigon in the bar in the press know that there are more people than, you know, we've been killing so many hundred every week. You know, the press ain't real smart, Mr. Adams, but they can do arithmetic, and there's no way that we could survive if they knew the truth." See, so Sam comes back to Washington, and he is really angry. He had served in Vietnam, so he knew what it was like. Okay. So we try manfully to get the real figures up the chain up there to the president, and guess what? Richard Helms, the CIA director at the time, punts. He tells us, we can't get involved in a big controversy with the U.S. Army when it's at war. That's not the way we protect the agency. So we were really, really, really scraping around to get some sort of way to get this word out. Now, what happened was Sam was a big, he's a true believer. He played by the rules, so he went to the Inspector General of the CIA, went to the Inspector General of the Pentagon, and went to Congress and got nowhere. Now, we're talking 1967, okay? After he got back from Saigon, he couldn't get a fair hearing. So he's saying in August of 1967 that there are 500,000 to 600,000 Vietnamese under arms in the South. Military is saying 299,000. What happens? Well, we get a cable from General Abrams, Westmoreland's deputy, and Abrams says in black and white, and I quote, "We cannot possibly go with the real figures because we have been projecting an image of success in this war. And there is no way, despite all the caveats we could adduce, that we could avoid the press reaching an erroneous and gloomy conclusion," period, end quote. Now, there's that cable, okay? It was very strictly held, of course. But Sam told me about it because we used to have lunch. And, I thought, wow, you know, somebody ought to take that cable, make a copy, and take it down to the New York Times Bureau in Washington. Oh, I probably should explain, Scott. In those days, the New York Times was an independent newspaper, and it didn't go to the White House with things like this to ask permission to publish it. It would just go ahead if it was newsworthy. No, really, it was newsworthy. Just
my God, that's like back in the olden days when pictures were all in black and white, and dictators roamed the earth.
So anyhow, you know, this is sort of jocular, but it's dead serious. I didn't have the guts to do it. And Sam was the kind of a guy who just wouldn't do it. He'd play, you know, he went through channels. And so to this day, I regret that I didn't have the courage of Edward Snowden or Bradley Manning or Julian Assange. You know, I had all the reasons not to do it, and I let those reasons prevail. Now, Sam Adams went to an early death with regret that he couldn't shake. That if he had gone public in 1967, and this was before the countrywide offensive by the communists during Tet in January and February of the next year, 1968, if he had gone public, there's a really good chance that those of you who know the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, well, there'd be no wing on the left side. There'd be no structure there because there'd be no names to carve into that granite. Okay. That's a heavy burden to carry around with you.
How did he die? When did he die?
Well, he had a sudden heart attack down in the cellar one day. He had no previous symptoms. And he died, I think it was about 84 or something, in 1984. He was
I've talked on the show, Ray, with Dan Ellsberg, and he feels the same way, that he really could have stopped the war in 1964 himself, and that he didn't do it. And Dan had cried about it on the show one time, I think. Took it real seriously.
We all come out of this experience, and I guess if there's any good news in this, it's that we've been candid, and we've been confessing, and we've been saying, Dan has always said, don't wait, don't do what I did. Don't wait until the war is well underway or almost over. And, you know, bring the documents. So, you know, what happened, of course, is Bradley Manning brought the documents to a fairly well, right? And Edward Snowden did the same thing. So I think Dan can be proud of the fact that not only did he encourage people to do this, but as soon as Snowden did what he did, as soon as Assange and as soon as Bradley Manning did what they did, Dan was out there defending them, saying, look, it's exactly the same thing that I've become a hero about, and you're calling them traitors. So long story short, neither Sam nor I had the courage to do this thing, but after Sam died, I thought that there might be, you know, it would be entirely appropriate to honor whistleblowers, people who did have the courage and the foresight and the, you know, the flexibility to go outside the system with the Sam Adams Prize. And so we just awarded our 12th. And it was just incredible. We always love to go and give the prize in person. And we, you know, we made that clear in the beginning, but I guess, truth be told, I never really thought we'd get to Moscow to give Edward Snowden his prize. But we did, and it was wonderful. It was an incredibly warm ceremony. We got to talk to him about 5 hours after the formal ceremony. We were welcomed by one of the NGOs there, headed by a really jocular Russian fellow named, I'll never remember, Kucherina was his name. And, you know, it was just an incredibly warm thing. And Snowden, if you'll see on Democracy Now!, if you like, he, you know, when I gave him the award and Tom Drake gave him the Corner Brightener candlestick, which is our, you know, our Oscar or our Emmy, I said to him, I whispered to him, I said, Ed, if you'd like to say a couple words, you know, that would be appropriate. So he sat down, and you could see the three-minute little speech he did ad lib, you know. It wasn't rehearsed or anything like that, but he's right on the mark with respect to the unconstitutionality of what he uncovered the NSA doing, how NSA's leaders have lied through their teeth, how Edward Snowden has told the truth and now is paying the price for that. But he's safe, and there are all kinds of ironies attached to this because he never in his life thought he would end up in Russia. But truth be told, he couldn't have found a safer spot. Why do I say that? Well, because, you know, the Mike Haydens, previous NSA and CIA director, and the Mike Rogers, who's now House Intelligence Chair, they both have said jocularly that they'd like to have a Snowden put on a kill list, right? Kill list for assassination. Well, he being in Russia, it's very unlikely, in my view, that any drones that go anywhere near where Snowden is, if they can find him, and still less likely is it that SEAL Team 6 or 7 or 5 or whatever will try to sort of jump in there and grab him. So, ironically, even though he never intended to be in Russia, he is there now. He's being well protected. He's as free as he can be. You know, there's so many people interested in finding out exactly where he is that he needs to be discreet about where he goes. But he certainly keeps up on everything. And when I asked him, you know, I said, do you know that General Hayden and, you know, and the head of the House Intelligence Committee have sort of suggested broadly that you be put on the kill list for assassination? He looked at me and he said, well, you know, he shook his head and he grimaced and he said, yeah, I know that. I keep up on that. But as if to say, what's this country really coming to? Unconscionable. You don't joke about things like, no, number one, you don't have a kill list. You know, the Fifth Amendment's supposed to be against that. But number two, you don't jocularly suggest that somebody you don't like, somebody who told the truth and exposed your lies, that he should be killed.
All right, so I want to hear more about what he said to you and your trip and really whatever all you want to say. There's just a couple of little points I wanted to, that little of points, but specific points I wanted to catch up on real quick before I turn it back over to you, you know, full time. First of all, this is a little bit of an irony being a former USSR analyst in Moscow giving a Freedom of Information type of award to somebody like this.
More than a little, Scott. My God, I was stationed at the embassy, but it was 40 years ago. Now, I knew there had been some changes. But the irony of this one, where, you know, I was followed every inch of the way, and it was pretty hostile surveillance, and here we are in a place where Snowden is watched over. He's protected, but he's not harassed. It's not the kind of harassing surveillance that I was subjected to. And irony of ironies, what he fears is the U.S. getting at him. He can't come home because he told the truth, and there are all kinds of very, very strong moneyed and military interests that are out to get him. So, you know, as I was driving to the studio at Democracy Now! This morning, I was thinking, hey, it's Columbus Day, and I was remembering the introduction to a chapter on the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus. It's out of Samuel Eliot Morison's history book, and it starts this way. America was discovered by someone who was looking for something else. The next two centuries were spent trying to figure out a way through it or around it. It was named after somebody who had nothing to do with the discovery of America, and the people were called after inhabitants of a nation on the other side of the world. History is like that, very chancy. Okay, yeah. Well, here's Edward Snowden. He looks at the example of Bradley Manning, of Tom Drake, of Julian Assange, and realizes that if he's to achieve his aims, he can't go through channels, that's for sure. And he can't even reveal his stuff within the U.S. And so he gets out of Dodge. He leaves his comfortable $100,000 salary, his girlfriend at his nice little place there in Honolulu, goes to Hong Kong, and, you know, by prearrangement, gives the data to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And then, you know, they're not medical missionaries. They're not Red Cross. They're correspondents. They take off and write their stories. And there's Ed Snowden. And so what happens? WikiLeaks to the rescue. Julian Assange and Sarah Harrison. Sarah goes down to Hong Kong, figures out a way to get him out of Hong Kong, en route to Russia, and then en route further to Cuba and Latin America, where he has been offered asylum. What happens?
Too bad they didn't go east there. He could have gone straight to Latin America. Why the long way around the earth to get to?
Because he would have had a transit someplace where they would have nabbed him. Mm. See, from Hong Kong to Russia, that's the long way, but they wouldn't nab him. In any case, on the way to Russia, he's deprived of his passport. So he arrives in Russia stateless. And for the next 5 weeks, like you know, like Columbus and the other explorers, he's trying to figure out a way through a way through Russia and not to stay there. But he's left with no choice. He asked for asylum. And Putin says, yeah, you can stay here, but as long as you don't divulge any more embarrassing material against our friend, the United States, knowing, of course, that, that Snowden had already shot his wad. All this stuff was available to Greenwald and others, and so it was a safe condition. So bottom line, as I said before, the height of the irony is that Snowden is safer in Russia than he ever would be in our country or any other country on the face of the globe.
Yeah. Well, one thing about Russia, they are independent from the American Empire, for sure. All right, now hold it right there, Ray. We got to take this break, everybody. We're online with Ray McGovern. We'll be right back on the Scott Horton Show after this.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I got to have commercials in this thing, man, so I can keep doing it. Ray McGovern, he's a nice guy. He's on the line. He's a former CIA analyst for 27 years. And now he's an anti-war activist. Thanks for holding on. I appreciate your patience there, Ray. And the thing is, what you talk about Snowden's journey, as it is, to where he's ended up more or less safe and sound, safe as he can be, at least for the time being, in Russia. It's important, I think, the kind of small point you made there, that he gave all his stuff to Greenwald, and then he took off. And then he got exiled, and Obama took his passport away and whatever. But Greenwald and Poitras, and I guess Gelman, I'm not exactly sure when he got his hands on what, but anyway, they got the stuff, and it's come out recently, at least he says, or WikiLeaks has said on his behalf, that he didn't even bring anything with him to Russia. That even, I think, paraphrasing him or something, even if they tortured him, he made sure that he didn't have anything to give them. So anyway, I was wondering what exactly he told you about that, because of course, as you're well aware, as the audience may well be aware, especially on the right, the slogan is, well, in all probability, he gave everything he had to the Chinese and the Russians, because why not? Time Magazine even ran basically a fantasy piece about, well, you know, I bet they probably drugged him and then he probably did whatever they wanted, the Rohypnol story in Time. Crying out loud. And it was, and he even said, now the following is my imagination about what I bet probably happened or something.
Yeah,
but anyway, so
yeah.
What do you know? What can you tell us about that?
Well, let's start with the famous four laptops. You know, remember the stories about him arriving in Hong Kong with four laptops. Well, you know, you don't store a lot of information on laptops. You use other media, okay? And so the laptop story is really a red herring, but it was a convenient diversion from what actually was given to Greenwald and Poitras. So that's one thing. The other thing is that really and truly, he doesn't have more to give. He gave it all up. Now, one might say, well, yeah, but you know, the KGB successors there, they can get at him, and you know, they can probably do enhanced interrogation techniques. You know, I wonder where we heard that before. Well, guess what? That's where WikiLeaks comes in. Sarah Harrison has been at his side from the day that she rescued him from Hong Kong. And so she's witness. She's witness to the fact that nobody's got at Ed Snowden. Nobody's drugged him. Nobody's, you know, done enhanced interrogation techniques against him. And that's big. That's a big witness. And, you know, for her to do that, that required quite a sacrifice, too. And, you know, she doesn't know if she can ever get back home in the U.K. because they'll get her at Heathrow. And, you know, so there's a lot of public-spirited, you know, I would say just really idealistic people here who are doing what they can to show that, hey, Ed, you know, you're not alone. And when we four arrived, you know, it was really pretty poignant. He hadn't seen anybody like us, of course, in months and months and months. And Tom Drake, from whose experience of 4 years of persecution at the hands of the Department of Justice, 10 felony counts, 35 years prison he was facing, okay? And when the judge decided that this was all a farce, he excoriated the Department of Justice lawyers, saying, you are unconscionable, you should be barred from further practice of law. This was no case at all, okay? So what he did was plead to a misdemeanor. He said that he pled guilty to exceeding approved use of government computers because he wrote his wife a couple of emails on her or something like that. Okay, for that he did some community service, but the whole thing was a farce. Now, the point of all this, of course, is that Snowden's watching all this stuff, right? And it is because of Drake's experience, as well as Assange, as well as Bradley Manning, that Snowden does it cleverly. He figures it all out. Now, he didn't figure much beyond Hong Kong, but that didn't matter to him. What mattered to him was getting this stuff out. If something bad happened to him after that, well, he didn't want that, but as I say, he was rescued. So
important. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to work in here real quick, and then you'll get the last word, is that it's not just that what they said about him wasn't true, that he's some kind of traitor and that never mind what you might learn from all of his awesome revelations because he's some bad guy. Not only is that not true, but all the people who said that, they were wrong at least and maybe lying. And think about how powerful that narrative was, that what this guy did, he did for his own selfish interest, betrayed us to foreign nations and whatever. And it's just not right. He's just a whistleblower, like dictionary definition.
That's exactly right, and that's what they want to project because they want to defend themselves. They're a bunch of liars. I mean, let's face it; they lied under oath, and nothing happened to them. But what I was about to say is, when Tom Drake walked in and Ed Snowden recognized him, it was a poignant moment because Snowden is looking at Drake and saying, "This is the guy whose example saved me," and Drake is looking at Snowden and saying, my God, those were really torturous 4 years of persecution. But you know what? Something good came out of that. If my example was used by Snowden to escape this kind of fate for himself, well, so be it. It may have been worth it, at least in that sense. So it was just a really poignant moment. And they gave each other a really big hug. And you could tell that they, as Tom said today earlier, you know, he can really identify with his fellow NSA whistleblower.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm stepping all over my own clock here. I didn't have to interrupt you to
no problem.
Get those words in edgewise there. I could have let you finish. I'm sorry, but Yeah, anyway, so the footage I saw that people can see on RT, I guess it's just RT.com, they have it all, or on their YouTube channel, et cetera, of you guys meeting with them and footage of you guys sitting there having a meal, whatever. And I'm sorry that we are pretty much up, out of time with half a minute to go here or something, but I want to thank you, and I want to invite you to come back maybe even later this week to finish talking about your time there. I'm going to, of course, have Colleen Rowley on if I can. And
great.
Maybe Thomas Drake to talk about their angle on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd be happy to have you back on to talk about your time there with more time, Ray. If
okay, just give me a call, Scott. Be happy to do it.
Okay, great. I sure appreciate your time again on the show, Ray.
Okay, bye now.
All right, Ray. That's Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst, and he writes for consortiumnews.com, and his own website is raymcgovern.com. And, yeah, bad timing at the end of that segment, I admit. But anyway, we'll be right back with Phil Giraldo to talk about Syria here in a minute. I think that's really great that they went to Russia to give him that award. Dude needs to know that people appreciate what he did, because he did do it for the right reasons. And, you know, face it, exile in, you know, relatively speaking, in Siberia, that ain't pretty, you know? Suburbs of Moscow, but still. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton, and next up on the show is our friend Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer, and now he writes for the American Conservative and Antiwar.com, and he's also the executive director of the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. And so, hey, let's start off with talking about the CNI a little bit there. What are you guys up to lately?
Well, as you know, CNI was founded about 20 years ago to by former ambassadors and congressmen to basically address the issue of American imbalance in its foreign policy in the Middle East. In the past 20 years, of course, we've moved along, but if anything, the problem has become bigger. We as a country are engaged in more conflicts in more places, and CNI has also expanded its role in bringing these conflicts and the reasons we go into them into the discussion. But basically, we want an American foreign policy that makes sense for the United States in terms of its vital interests, and we feel that we haven't had anything like that for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, I think it's definitely true that the problem of the Israel lobby and their inordinate influence of Washington, D.C. probably is better known than ever. But then again, their power has been growing separately this whole time, too. So
but they've had a defeat recently. The Syria business was a defeat. And depending on what happens with Iran, that could turn out to be a defeat, too. So, you know, they're not unbeatable. And it really is up to we, the people, to assert that we really want the government to be doing stuff for us that's in our interests.
Mm. Well, you know, Alan Grayson, who he's pretty Israel and AIPAC friendly, he had a comment about the Syria thing where somebody asked him, what about AIPAC? And the way he responded was interesting. He said that, well, you know, AIPAC is great and everything, but when, I'm roughly paraphrasing, AIPAC is great and everything, but when the American people speak with one voice, then forget about it. You know, AIPAC is nothing. So in other words, it's sort of the default is to do what they want. But if the American people say, then
that's not the default, but we go with that. We do what they want because we have to.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess, you know, the intensity of the feeling about, you know, not attacking Syria was such that I think a lot of congressmen began to feel the breeze. And that normally, of course, does not happen.
Right, yeah, we got lucky on that one. Well, and, you know, there were enough generals speaking out against it, and the British didn't want to go along. A lot of people wanted to get out of that thing by the time it was about to happen, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was just one of these really bad ideas that seemed to come to the surface in Washington every once in a while. And this time, fortunately, we were able to reverse it. But, you know, we've had some bad ideas in the past that unfortunately we weren't able to reverse, like Iraq.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. And, you know, thank goodness, as much as people try to ignore that war, they do still remember that. They remember how easily they convinced themselves to go along with the push for it, too, most of them, even though they probably wouldn't admit it like that. But that's part of it, right? They're like, boy, this might not work out so well.
Yeah, that's the thing. The gold standard for really being deceived as a country is Iraq. And every time one of these new, shall we say, programs comes up from the White House, people immediately start thinking of Iraq. So in a way, Iraq will turn out maybe to be a good thing for the United States.
Yeah, well, it's got its silver lining anyway. But yeah, that was what I always says. George Bush, he's secretly one of us. He's just doing the only way he knows how to completely discredit foreign interventionism from now on. He's got to do it the hard way, but there you go.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Yeah, well, yeah, poor Iraqis and everybody else, but still.
Yeah,
and it's, of course, the amount of money blown, too, has got a lot to do with it.
That's right. That's where a lot of our deficit comes from, right?
Well, and, you know, it's funny because you're, I think, the first person in journalism to report that Obama had signed new findings. This would have been in December of 2011 at antiwar.com, that Obama had signed two findings, one on Iran and one on Syria, stepping up covert action there, which you had from your CIA sources and that kind of thing. And yet you also have been saying for, I don't know, a year or so that, nah, they figured out that as dumb as they are, that this is even too dumb for them, and they're sort of backing down, and they'll never back the rebels, or not deliberately anyway, back the rebels enough to help them really win. And they actually have seen the light, at least as long as a year ago, right? After, probably not long after, maybe the day that Obama accidentally laid down that red line, which apparently didn't really mean to do.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence that they really do realize how stupid these policies are. And certainly if you listen to what Dempsey is saying over at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you'll get a lot of contrary insights into, you know, that there are lots of people in the administration, particularly in the Pentagon and in the intelligence community, who've had problems with these programs right from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's plenty to deal with, and maybe we can go into detail later about the nature of the so-called rebellion there and who's who and what it all means as part of this. But I think everybody's more or less getting a grip on the fact that as bad as Assad is, the opposition is not better, by any measure, really. But so, I mean, your article at antiwar.com, Phil, says that, you know, despite all the negative things to look at here, there really is the basis for a possible deal if the Americans were willing to, I guess, pressure their regional allies to work with them and try to drag everybody kicking and screaming to Geneva or something and hammer something out. You say it could be hammered out rather than, you know, the nightmare, which is like Patrick Coburn was saying on the show last week that, you know, this is a lot like Lebanon in the 70s and 80s, which is a nightmare, you know, the same thing that we have now, only from now on.
Yeah, I think this thing was negotiable from 5 years ago. The big mistake was the United States felt that by playing this game with the regime there, that they would produce some positive result. And of course, that was a fiction. And what they should have been doing, instead of putting ambassadors in, taking ambassadors out, closing the embassy, opening the embassy, sending in a new ambassador who would then go around and talk to the opposition, and guarantee that the government wouldn't talk to them. You know, it was this kind of stupid game that they've been playing. And I've been convinced right from the beginning that that there was a lot of wiggle room in terms of how Al-Assad, who is not the monster that he's been depicted as, how he would have responded if there had been some reasonable overtures made at that time by us. But we didn't do that.
Well, yeah, and in fact, you know, they told the rebels, basically, don't negotiate with them. We got your back. Back in...
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we did. So basically, we created a civil war. And essentially, you know, what I'm saying now is that I think that everybody is so tired of this that if somebody were to demonstrate a little leadership, we probably actually could work out some kind of negotiated solution that would make most parties happy. And or at least most parties content. Let's not say happy, but you know that's what I'm saying.
All right, but so who's going to lead the fight against the guy who's been doing all the fighting so far? Because you can't bring a bunch of suicide bombers to Geneva; they might suicide bomb something, like they did today, by the way.
Yeah, the point is you have to work out in your own mind, or you know, what is an acceptable group to bring to the table and what isn't. I would say that the two definitely Al Qaeda affiliated groups are outside the pale. But you know, there are ways to incorporate other genuine Syrians, not foreigners, who are engaged in the conflict. Foreigners, you know, basically they're going to have to either go or get killed, but basically these people are not going to be part of the settlement. But they, you know, if they came to terms with some kind of supervised election that would avoid massacres of the Alawites, massacres of the Christians, would create some kind of guaranteed protection for those groups, I think people would come to an agreement. I think a lot of what we see in terms of the regime hanging on is the fact that they know they're all going to get killed if they lose. And you know, you work out a way to avoid that option, and also on the other side for the rebels to avoid that option, and suddenly things start to fall into place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in fact, like you said at the beginning, the thing turned into a war. But before that, they were really—I don't know if they were really making progress, but they were making some progress on concessions. Hey, what if we did that? What if we did this and held some elections and rewrote the Constitution and. You know, I don't know how half-hearted or even less it might have been, but it seemed like the basis for a negotiation right from the beginning, before it turned into a war.
Yeah. I agree. That's essentially what we saw. I mean, there was wiggle room in terms of people being able to negotiate the issue, but unfortunately, we blew that.
But in a sense, you're sort of saying send in Petraeus and try to redo the awakening thing, right? Where you get the local Sunni imams to turn on the foreigners and the worst extremists of the suicide bomber types and make a deal. But of course,
no, I think everybody has a vested interest actually in getting rid of the radicals, and I'm talking about Syrians. I don't really care about you know what the interests of the Iraqis who are fighting or the Saudis who are fighting inside Syria, what their interests are, because they're not Syrians. And I think if we go to actual Syrians and we go to actual neighbors who have a vested interest in stability on their border, we suddenly find that a lot of people have things that they can contribute to some kind of agreement. Mm-hmm.
All right, now, so, but if I'm the Secretary of State, can I call, which, God, thank goodness I'm not John Kerry in this life, but anyway, if I was him, could I call some Saudi princes and say, you have to stop because we've made a policy decision that you have to stop? They have to do what we say, right, or not?
Well, they have to do what we say, at least on the surface. They're going to continue to play their own agenda, which is going to be, I mean, for the Saudis, this is a simple kind of equation. It's that if you see this block of countries aligned basically against you, and this block is Iran, that's next to Syria, that's next to Lebanon with Hezbollah. So this is the Saudi perception, which is actually somewhat similar to the Israeli perception, and so you have this is what's driving them. They don't want this thing, this contiguous block of hostile territory, to be in the neighborhood. So that's why they want to overthrow Assad. They wanted to overthrow Assad for at least 10 years. And the fact is that, you know, they can be convinced that there are other kinds of security arrangements and that Syria can go another way if genuinely they're going to go along with it. But at the same time, you don't necessarily have to do that. You could just sort of pressure them. The United States is the security, basically the security umbrella for Saudi Arabia. And as such, it has a lot of weight. And so there are ways to convince them.
Yeah, I mean, we sell them a lot of weapons, but our guys are their army. They don't even have an army except for internal oppression, right?
Yeah, that's basically true. I mean, their army is not an army in the sense that it could fight one of their bigger neighbors or anything like that, like Egypt or Iran. It couldn't. But the fact is that it's the United States basically de facto provides a security umbrella for the Gulf states and for Saudi Arabia against its neighbors. And they know that. Yeah. And so ultimately, that you know, we're the ultimate guarantor of their ability to continue to run an autocracy. So, you know, they know that, and they're going to accept that. And basically, if the United States comes down with enough pressure, they're going to go along with what the United States wants.
Right. All right, so you're alluding to this this kind of Shiite arc, which, of course, the neocons identified before the Iraq War and thought the Iraq War was going to help their position, which, of course, it just made the Shiite arc, you know, alliance of powers that much stronger with now Baghdad in alliance with Tehran and Damascus and Hezbollah. I don't know if Hezbollah has a capital city. I guess not, but southern Lebanon there.
Well,
anyway.
Tripoli, I guess, more than any. Yeah, but the difference here is that the Sunnis are in the majority in Syria. So basically, right. Whatever formula you're going to come up with, it's not going to be part of a Shiite arc. And this is exactly what the Saudis have been trying to create for 10 years, that there be a Sunni regime. Unfortunately, they also want that Sunni regime to embrace their horrific vision of Islam, which is Wahhabism, which is unfortunately part of the package. But nevertheless, the idea is they see Syria as a natural break in this Shiite bloc, which runs, as you note, from, you know, Iran through Iraq, and then leaps over to Lebanon.
Mm. Well, so do you think in any real deal that Assad will have to step down, and it'll be, well, and at that point, is it going to be the decapitation of the entire Alawite government there and the fall of the government itself, or is it just going to be a change of kingship at the top, or how's that going to work?
Go any one of a number of ways. I mean, the point is that I don't think al-Assad want to stay in power. I don't think he wants to stay in power right now. I think that the whole issue for him is that his regime, which is essentially made up largely of his tribe, essentially would get slaughtered if he were to go. So the fact is, in any kind of settlement, you have to work out some kind of arrangement to guarantee that you don't go the Iraq route and have instant genocide. So, I mean, that's of course something that would have to be worked out. You might have to have peacekeeping forces. You might have to have a UN presence. I don't doubt any of that.
Yeah. Well, and in your article, you point out and link to this statement by Michael Oren, the former, I guess, outgoing Israeli ambassador to the United States, being very upfront and honest about this and that. I mean, it's between the lines anyway. The reason America backs the Sunni jihadists in Syria is because the Israelis have a much bigger problem, they think anyway, have a much bigger problem with Hezbollah and Iran, and obviously Syria as the key in the arch there, than they do with Al-Qaeda, at least for now. And so that's why America's policy is to back our enemies against their enemies.
Yeah, and the Israelis are seeing it precisely the same way the Saudis see it, which is essentially that they think it's better to have a radical regime in Syria, which is kind of in a state of civil war, than it is to have a government there that's friendly to Iran. So it's exactly the same kind of thinking, and as you point out, of course, the thinking on all these issues tends to be wrong 5 years down the road. But you know, it's just I think all I'm saying is that basically there are a lot of wheels and there are a lot of levers in this problem. And until you start kind of playing around and figuring out what the real equities and what the real issues are, you can't really approach any kind of settlement. But there's no reason why that can't be something that's ongoing. I think the fact that we started to talk to the Syrians, but with aid of the Russians, over the chemical weapons is a sign that there are people there that are willing to negotiate.
Right. Well, and I think we talked about this before, how the deal with the Russians over the chemical weapons is a de facto acceptance more than, you know, reading between the lines. It's maybe not officially stated, but pretty close to officially stated that, okay, so we're not even trying regime change now because, of course, we have to keep him there to give up all his chemical weapons to us. So, and of course, if that's the red line, where if he crosses that, then we'll bomb you. If he gets rid of all the last bit of it, then there's no possibility he's going to cross the red line anymore. So, in other words, Obama's going to let him live. And I guess thank goodness for that. Not that he's any good, but at least it could be that much worse, you know, considering American intervention.
Yeah, I think the way we have to look at it, given the sorry record of American interventions over the last 15 years, is that basically it will turn out badly. But the hope is that it will turn out less badly if you do certain things than if you don't. So that's kind of the way I see it.
Yeah. Well, now for people who want some fun history about this, there's always, especially those maybe not too familiar, I always like recommending A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm and Dealing with Crumbling States. Both of them are primarily authored by David Wurmser, who was, I guess, the leash on Colin Powell and then Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor in the Bush Jr. years there. And what he says in Dealing with Crumbling States about Syria is that what we need to do is focus on expediting the chaotic collapse, so that then that way we'll have a better opportunity to shape the future and whatever, which of course is a big assumption. But anyway, that's the way they look at it. That like Michael Ledeen used to like to say, let's turn the whole region into a boiling cauldron. And then we'll see, you know, what comes out of that. And then we'll bomb that too, I guess.
Yeah, except Ledeen always accepted Israel from that generalization. But the fact is that Israel has long, or some people in Israel have long believed that the best solution for all of its neighbors is to turn them into chaotic little civil war zones where everybody is fighting against everybody else. Now, certainly, that would make Israel, in a sense, more secure in that it wouldn't be confronting any Arab armies. But at the same time, the blowback from that kind of development, the situation that develops alongside the chaos, could be worse than dealing with a guy like al-Assad, who actually honored all his agreements with Israel and was fairly moderate in his relationship with them.
Yeah, or even Nasrallah, if the alternative is Zawahiri, for crying out loud.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, imagine, is it impossible for Netanyahu to ask himself, I wonder what it would be like if 3 years from now the Baathists are gone and it's the reign of the suicide bombers on my northern border, huh? When Hezbollah, of course, hadn't done suicide bombings in I don't know how many years, and only when they were invaded and occupied.
Yeah, I mean the whole and the, of course as everyone knows now, the whole opposition in Syria is infiltrated with jihadis from all kinds of places. I saw this estimate that I cite in my article of 800 Saudis alone fighting in on the side of the Syrian rebels, and there are hundreds of Chechens. There are all kinds of people from all over the world that have gravitated to there, and so the question becomes, you know, is this what you want on your border? Do you think this is going to be a better solution?
Right. All right. Well, so finally, this is all common sense stuff for anybody looking at this and just watching the headlines. So, and you know, I know that they got secret information that I don't know, Phil. But I wonder if you think that Obama maybe finally gets it, that the way to undo all this problem is just go ahead and make friends with Iran. And then you just you make friends with your enemy, and then he's not your enemy anymore. Problem solved, Shiite arc neutralized or whatever, right? Even from the empire's point of view. I'm trying to look from the empire's point of view, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's the right answer for the empire. There's no question about it. You know, it's in fact, once you neutralize the political problems, all kinds of other things have a tendency to change too. I mean, you talk about, you know, they keep citing the fact that Iran is not a great place to live, politically speaking, if you're in the opposition, that it doesn't have fundamental liberties and rights, and that's only partly true, but the fact is that it nevertheless has a certain credibility. But once you kind of open the door to other things, things do change. I mean, you only have to cite the example of Southeast Asia, you know, that we fought a war with not so long ago. And suddenly, when you stop threatening them, when you stop being an existential threat to them, things have a tendency to change.
Yeah. Well, hey, they're working out a nuke deal with the communist Vietnamese government right now. Did you see that?
Right. Yeah, they are.
I mean, not that they're really communist anymore, but it's still the Communist Party dictatorship government there. So, you know, the heirs of the former enemy, for sure. And here they are doing a nuke deal with them, for crying out loud, which I guess is all right, well, you know, as long as it's a light water reactor, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, in fact, Iran has freer elections than Vietnam. And yet now we forgive and forget about Vietnam, and yet we're still on this hobby horse about how non-liberal Iran is. But Iran has freer elections than a lot of places that are American allies.
Well, this is just a crisis of American power, right? Because they thought that with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, they'd just inherit the whole earth. But then it turned out there was nobody left to scare them into America's camp anymore. So the whole world's been spinning out since then. And so if they don't have Iran and the Gulf states and whatever is fake enemies with each other, then who needs America at all?
Well, that's a good point. I kind of like the American first philosophy of the 30s. You know, let's just pull in within the two oceans and leave everybody alone and have them leave us alone. You know, I think that's becoming more attractive.
Yeah, it turns out if you ask them, they don't need us anyway. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
If we would just quit making enemies out of everybody. Well, so now the talks start tomorrow, officially, the nuke talks in Iran. You got your hopes up at all, or this is just another October 09, or what?
I think there are more negatives here than positives. I think that the lobby is still strong enough to compel Obama to make demands that he knows will not be acceptable. I think that's what's going to happen. But at the same time, you know, I'm somewhat optimistic about this. I think that this is an opening. You know, it's an opening in the door that's been closed, and I have a feeling it could go the other way. If I had to bet money on it, I would say it's not. It's going to go the usual route of let's make impossible demands so there can't possibly be an agreement. But you know, there are a lot of people suddenly on board, and the media is talking about it, and the positive things that are being said about these talks are all over the place. So I don't know. I don't know. I would obviously love to see it go the right way for a change.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is what our old friend Gordon Prather wrote back years ago, was, hey, you want to be Obama the Great? And so all you got to do is make a big peace deal, right? You don't need a big war. You need a big peace deal, and we'll put you on Mount Rushmore. How about that? It's easy. You can do it. I like it. I don't know if he'll go for
it. I like it,
or
too.
Not, but... All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, Phil. It's great to talk to you again.
Okay, Scott. Bye-bye.
Take care. All right, everybody. That's Phil Giraldi, former CIA, now executive director of the Council for the National Interest and writer at antiwar.com and the American Conservative Magazine. That's it for the show. Thanks for listening. New hours, 3 to 5 Eastern time here on Liberty Express. No agenda.